Hello, I'm Charlotte Armitage and this is Objects. On this episode, I'm speaking to Chris Law MP. Chris grew up in Fife and when he left school, he trained as a chef before graduating from St Andrews University with a degree in cultural and social anthropology. After spending 10 years running tours of the Himalayas on a 1950s motorcycle, Chris returned to Scotland and became a prominent figure during the Yes campaign in 2014. The following year, Chris was elected as Member of Parliament for Dundee West, and he is now the SNP spokesperson on international development and climate justice. In Westminster, Chris has spoken on universal credit, nuclear disarmament, and in 2018, Chris revealed his care experience publicly for the first time during a House of Commons debate on foster care. This was the first time I'd ever heard a politician candidly talking about the stain of shame people like myself hid from the world as we grew up. Chris, thank you so much for joining me on Objects.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Chris, many people will know you and Dundee as their elected representative, but I'm interested to hear a wee bit more about you. Can you tell me some more about yourself?
Sure. Well, I didn't come into politics in a traditional sense. And in fact, I kind of threw myself in during the 2012 to 2014 campaign for independence. And after the demise of the result, I felt I had no choice but to go into politics. But my background is quite eclectic career-wise. But even before that, my care time is very eclectic. At 3 months old, I was adopted from a hospital in Edinburgh. I know a little bit about my natural mother in as much as although I haven't had any contact with her, she gave me up within the first few weeks. The weird thing was when I was turning 30, I found some documents in my mother's house, which she'd asked through the agency that was involved for a photograph of me at 6 months old, which gave me a real puncture of how I perceived it before that actually she cared about me beyond being adopted. 3 years later, my brother, my adoptive brother from another family, was adopted from another hospital in Edinburgh. He was also 3 months old at the point of adoption. And then we grew up in Fife, just outside Kirkcaldy, as two brothers with two parents who had their own issues. They were having a very difficult marriage. They were both lonely children in their own family backgrounds. They didn't have the same support, I guess, as more extended families. And so by the age of 9, 10, they split. My brother consequently went to live with his dad and I went to live with my mother on a pretty rough council house estate in Fife. And life got a lot more difficult then. And it led to foster care, assessment centres. There was discussion about psychiatric care and I wasn't having that. And then the opportunity, and I call it an opportunity because I really needed it, to go into a children's home. And it's called St David's and in St Andrews, funnily enough. And one of the nicest things about it when I went to visit was it was right next to the beach. So it was a real break for me. I was 14 at the time and it was quite disruptive at school, very disruptive at home. And I was living with a single mother who also had very progressive multiple sclerosis. So she found it very difficult to care on her own benefits. So it was a very tumultuous time. So I was in care for a good bit over a year. And actually, it was such a good care home, I didn't actually want to leave, but I was coming up to 16. And if I go back to the 80s, when you're 16, that was pretty much the end of your care support. So you either went home or you got put into a flat or into B&B, I think we talked about earlier today. So it was quite difficult. And then when I left care, I went back home very briefly, but I didn't want to live at home anymore. So I trained to be a chef and I managed to get live-in residency in a country hotel, and that was me left home.
Wow. So you told us quite a bit about your care experience, but I want to hear a bit about your process of chosen objects. A lot of people have said that they've went on a bit of a journey looking for objects. So how was it for you to find your objects? Did they come quickly to you? Did you know what you were wanting as soon as you had the opportunity?
You know, I'd have thought this would have been easy. When I heard you want me to bring objects along, I thought this will be fine. And I knew the first object, which is actually the last object I'll talk about. And there's quite a lot around that object. And it's quite ironic, really, given my own background. And then I thought about an object during care, and that became virtually impossible. And then pre-care, It was also very difficult. And I think the first thing I really want to say about that was that, for me at least, actually, I love objects and I love the stories to tell about people's lives. I did a degree in social anthropology, and one of the main parts of my thesis was objects and about how people put their own sense of their value and sense of self into objects. So when I got asked about this opportunity, I thought, great, because I've asked loads of other people to do it for me. Yet I found it very, very difficult and very protracted. And even this morning, I was up really early, for me at least, raking around the house trying to work out what is it I want to bring and why. So I've managed to bring half of one, mm-hmm. none of the second, and the full of the third, if that makes any sense.
It's interesting. That leads us quite nicely then onto your first object, which represents before care. Chris, what is your first object?
Okay, so my first object is worn by others. So, and the reason I chose it, I was 10 years old. My family had split up. I was staying actually with my mother at her mother's house, so my grandparents. Very difficult time, and school by this point for me was becoming a period of containment, even though I'm still in primary. And very low self-esteem. I'd arrived in a new town. It was Leslie, which is a small town near Glenrothes and Fife. And there was a competition. And the competition, I was in primary six at this point, so I was probably 10 going on 11, was to design the new primary school badge. And it was one thing I had a bit of flair for, a bit of art, and I didn't take it that seriously. And I remember it was an afternoon and we all sat down with our colouring pens and crayons and stuff, and we had to design a badge. And the first thing I thought about was the school colours, which are, I'm looking from here, it's black and red. And I also thought of something that's really symbolic of the area, which is a viaduct, which is now a walking viaduct, but previously we'd had a steam train going over it, and it connects Leslie with Glenrothes. So as I look at this badge now, it's two arches in red and black, which is the school colours, which identify the bricks, and LPS across the top, which is Leslie Primary School, and water at the bottom. Now, the reason I've chosen this is not because I feel a great success from it, it's quite the opposite. And to this day, you know, we're talking more than 30 years, thousands of kids have now worn this on their blazer. And I was such an awful kid at school. I just really didn't pay attention to anything. And I just wasn't interested. And two, 3 weeks later, the decision of which badge was to be chosen was by an artist who'd done a lot of public artwork in Glenrothes. Glenrothes is a new town, and there's some amazing big sculptures in Glenrothes. And I got actually asked to leave the class, and ordinarily when I got asked to leave the class, I was either going to get the belt or I was off to see the head teacher. But in this case, I went out to the class and the head teacher was with the artist, and he wanted to tell me privately, bearing in mind I'm age 10, that I've won a prize. They've chosen my badge design. Now, normally I would have thought kids would be really excited and filled with joy. I was actually felt, shame's not the right word, but like I've been conned. They're doing this because they feel pity for me, because I'm just quite disruptive. And I felt like this is some sort of fob off. I genuinely felt like that. And it's hard to say that today because I look at the badge and it's quite a cool design, frankly. but at the time, I remember thinking, nah, they're just trying to make me feel better. And clearly, this is my first year in this new school. And clearly, I was not feeling like I was either deserving or that that I should have won this. However, 3 weeks later, it was the summer, and we're coming up to final assembly and the prize giving, and I was awarded a £2 gift voucher for John Menzies newsagents, which I subsequently went and bought. What I couldn't think what you could spend £2 on. £2 is quite a lot of money then, and I bought a Papermate pen in a sort of plastic case, which I was quite proud of.
And how does it feel now, just like looking at that, and it's been so many years, and that is still the badge, and it came from that young person, that young boy, who didn't actually think they deserved to be the winner. How does that feel?
It's a real juxtaposition, because even at the time when I designed it, I never gave it much thought. I was the first to hand it in. It was done in 15 minutes flat, and we had 2 hours to do this. So that was part of the reason, perhaps, why I felt it. But also, I was in a different, in my headspace and in my heart at the time, I was in a different place, and I wasn't in a good place. I wasn't sure that I had self-awareness of it then, or indeed reflection on it. I was quite young. I reflect on it now. So I look at the badge as I'm sitting here now, and I've never really paid any attention to it since I left school. This was really an odd decision for me, but I was glad to bring it along because it said a lot of where I was at the time. And I'm quite proud of it. It's quite a good design. I love the fact that they've still got in a kind of quirky hand-drawn nature, and that's the way it is. It's not been done by computer design to this day as a school badge. And actually, Leslie Primary School probably don't even know I'm sitting here doing this podcast about that badge. And I actually don't own one, so I must go and get one now. So I'm quite proud. Sometimes the best ideas are at the spur of the moment, so I'm quite pleased with that. But I also reflect a little bit of sorrow about how I felt about it when I should have felt quite delighted and happy and something to be, excited about. I don't even remember coming home to my mum to talk about it and my gran. I just remember it happened to me rather than it was part of my, life's journey.
And do you think that's because there was so much else going on in your childhood that this...
I think so. It's hard now because I look back, it's a long time ago, but my priorities then were just trying to fit in, and I didn't feel like I fit in. I think I can't speak for all adopted young people, but I was always an outsider. I still think of myself as an outsider today. And so when you're an outsider growing up, which I thought where I grew up before I moved to Leslie, that because I lived outside of town, outside the village, I wasn't that connected with young people of my age. I also felt outside because my adoptive parents had their own issues. But I also felt outside because I was adopted. And I was told about that when I was probably about 6 years old. That, by the way, you didn't come from us, you came from Edinburgh. And I something else I've never, ever shared was that I think for my parents who equally had difficult upbringings of their own as lone children, that they had real difficulties being parents to us, in the best way they could, but real difficulties. Very heavy on discipline. Boys should be seen and not heard. And the pressures on us, both myself and my brother Alistair, were quite tough. And at this stage, I think we were still together before we got separated as to our mother and father, with me, with my mum, and my brother with our father. So I have mixed feelings about it when I look at it. But I'm pleased to talk about it today because it's the first time I've talked about it since I designed it.
So it's a happy moment. Mm-hmm. You kind of touched on it a little bit now, looking back. What kind of impact do you think this period of your life has had on you now?
Yeah, so I think the ability, so on the positive side, resilience and adaptability. I think I've spoken to quite a number of care experienced kids, Charlotte, in over my adult life. But so friends I've chosen, I've actually got friends I didn't think about till quite recently, who we all share something in common. My closest friend, Simon, we worked together on another national campaign for independence for Scotland called the Spirit of Independence. And Simon's been a friend of mine for nearly 30 years. And he spent more than half of his young childhood in care. My other closest friend is also called Chris. He was adopted at a young age, and yet his parents went on to have two sons of their own, biological sons, 10 years later. These are people I totally feel at ease with and at home with. And yet we never sat down to have a chat particularly about experiencing care or what it's like to be adopted. In fact, as I've not mentioned so far, but being in politics now, I wasn't even prepared to talk about it politically. And it was only in February last year, which was February 2018, there was a debate in Parliament on foster care. It's not my brief. My brief is I'm a frontbench spokesperson on international development and also climate, which are two major topics just now and very important to where Scotland goes in the world and also to where everybody shares in trying to protect our environment. But there was a debate where they couldn't find a speaker in the SNP, in our group, for foster care. And it was literally 9 o'clock at night, and the debate was 9:30 the next morning, which doesn't give you the greatest time to research. And I happened to walk into our office where the chief whip is, Patrick Grady, who's a local MP here in Glasgow, and he said, Chris, we really need somebody to do this debate tomorrow on foster care. My immediate response is, what the hell do I know about foster care? You want me to speak about care? Why are you asking me? And immediately bristled, and I got defensive. And I said, Patrick, actually, you got a minute? And I said, well, you know, actually, I wasn't care. And I haven't even given it any thought since I was a teenager. In fact, it's a period I never wanted to talk about. So there I was 12 and a half hours later, going to be standing up in Parliament to put on public record not only some of the key issues, very fundamental issues, particularly for outcomes of people who've been in care, whether that be in residential care or whether it be in foster care, temporary care or kinship care even, or whether for the mixture of most of them, which I have. And here I was having to speak about it. And it was one of the most difficult debates that I've had to do. I had to write it down literally word for word so that I didn't stammer at the points where I want to say, you know, this is some of the issues. So the issues, from a politician's point of view, the issues are quite macro. They're usually statistical. They're based on evidence or the rest. But I really want to talk about the personal side of this. I also want to say thank you to those who supported me to get to where I am today. So resilience and adaptation are things I think those of us that have been in care learn to be. We learn to adapt to very immediately changing circumstances. Pretty much most of us are pretty charismatic because we need to be to get on, particularly the challenges we face. But on the flip side of that, there is the insecurity, the need to fit in, the need to feel okay about ourselves. And, you know, I'm approaching my, dare I say, sixth decade. I'm not going to tell you how soon that is. But I approach it still with all these childhood anxieties that obviously I've matured and developed with. In adult life, I've had a variety of careers. When I say I'm your non-typical politician, I really mean that because first career I trained in French cuisine, I became a fully qualified French chef. Then I went to study to get into university, but I didn't quite want to go yet, so I went and lived in Europe for a year, and I grew flowers for a living in a greenhouse. And then I spent a year in India, and I'm passionate about motorcycles. And actually, I had a motorcycle when I was 15 when I shouldn't have, but that's another story. But then that led on for me running, leading expeditions in the Himalayas to the world's highest roads. And I was the youngest person in the world doing it at the time. I was in my mid-20s, and it was very novel at that time. And then since then, I worked in filmmaking, I worked in financial services, and now I'm in politics. So, but I think that a lot of that is me just being able to adapt and be resilient and to look at opportunities and want to be involved. And actually, I'm really grateful for this opportunity to do this interview because now I want to really support other people who, whatever age in their lives, because, you know, some of us have never talked about care. And when I talked about care in Parliament, I talked about my dirty stain of shame, which I came to me as I was speaking. And that's what it felt like, I have to say. And it doesn't feel like that now speaking today. But that's only 18 months ago when I did feel like that. So that's quite important to me. When I've spoken to people since about, by the way, do you feel like that about your time in care? Do you talk about your time in care at all? Is it something you try to hide or keep out of the way? Invariably, I hear the answer is yes. And it doesn't matter which generation I'm talking to. So I see it as a source of strength. Really, I do. But also, it's also something that drives me personally, helps me push forward, and I have to work twice as hard as a result, just to feel okay with it. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay with that if it means feeling okay, you know.
That's lovely. You've spoken there about the impact that before care and actually being in care has had on you during your life. I think it would be good to then lead on to your second object, which represents during care. Can you tell me what your second object is?
Well, my second object is I don't have one. And I was thinking about this long and hard because I had a good week to think about what the objects could be. And I went through a variety of objects I no longer have. So my favourite object when I was in care was a record deck. I discovered music properly at 14. I was, you know, and I was around other young people, also a couple of years older than me. So we had a wing of our children's home, which were for 16 to 18 year olds. So their taste was a bit more mature. Let's say I was 13, 14. So I got into UB40 and I got into, Young at Heart came out, the Bluebells, which only heard recently on the last episode or the second last episode of Still Game. Don't know if you've seen it, but it's a bit where they get married and this music comes on. I'm like, wow. And they're back touring again, so I'm showing my age a bit. But it was also sort of late punk. There was still punk really. And in a children's home, punk was important because although we're talking about early to mid-80s here and punk was past its maturation stage. It was really, we were getting to that 80s crap music, I have to say, which is kind of, you know, artificial music. But so punk was quite important as well. And although I wasn't into punk deliberately, it was unintentional because of those that was around. And also the beat and the specials and madness are really important. But the weird thing is, and I was talking to Jerry, who works in my office, about this, that actually the first album I bought, and again, I don't have a copy here, so I'm afraid I don't have objects, was Purple Rain by Prince. People laugh when I tell them this now. But in 1984, you had a choice of kind of poppy music. It was kind of a bit, didn't identify for me. And I did identify with poppy Scots music, and I did identify with kind of punk music, but I wasn't a punk. But there's a cinema in St Andrews, and it's a really old cinema, and it's still open to this day. And Purple Rain, the movie was on. I didn't even know who Prince was, and I went along to see it. And I've suddenly discovered I love Prince, much to the horror of most of my pals in the children's home, which made me rebel a bit more. So I went and bought the album, and I used to play it incessantly. And actually, through my late teens and my early 20s, I continued to listen to Prince. So I don't have an object as such. But I had a positive experience in care. I had great staff that supported me. It was what I needed. They were called uncles and aunties. So the boss was Uncle Eddie. And if you're called into his office in the children's home, you were definitely in trouble. But it was really fair. And then Aunt Nan was really tough. She was the oldest. And she was quite old school. But she had a good sense of humour. And Aunt Kate would cut my hair. And you can tell by now, my hair doesn't get cut very often because it's very long. And Uncle Pete would take us long walks. And Uncle John was your did you knows. If you wanted to know about stuff, he'd have the answer. And I had a great time. And when I first arrived, I was 14. And I was asked if I'd like to help decorate our living room. And so I was a wallpaperer, and it was shocking, actually, in the job I did, but we're allowed to keep it up. So, and I think the reason I don't have objects from that time goes back to that thing about the dirty stain of shame. When I left care, I was almost 16 to the point when I left care, I didn't want to leave. I actually enjoyed my time there, and I had a choice between going to live in a flat with a pal of mine, which I'd have been utterly hopeless with when I think back on it now. Imagine living independent at 16 with no job and no idea what you want to do. Or I could go back to mum's who was suffering from advanced multiple sclerosis. She was wheelchair bound by this point. And that was a challenge because she was moving to Dundee, where I live and represent now, which is I feel utterly privileged to do so. And it was a house. It was a bungalow, in fact, semi-detached, and amongst other able-bodied as well as disabled bodies, where maybe a member of the family is disabled. And my brother was coming. He'd actually went with my mother there. He'd left his dad. I haven't seen my dad since 11. He died when I was 23. I still couldn't tell you where he's buried to this day, actually. So I had this real choice between being forthright and independent and taking all those risks at 16, setting up in Kirkcaldy, or moving to Dundee, which was actually a great move. But by that point, I was pretty ready to leave home. And although I went to college and I trained as a chef, as soon as I got an opportunity with a job with a place to live, so I lived in it as a country house hotel, and I got a room at 17, I was on my way.
So there's lots and lots of stuff in that bit there. How did you find going from care and having that happy time, having that like uplifting and then music-inspired time to going back and being in that environment that you were taken away from in the first place?
Well, it was, for my mother and my brother, it was a good move. We had a fresh start. You know, there was the breakup of the family, living with my grandparents, going into a council estate, which was really rough. Then going into a mixture of foster care, assessment centre, children's home. So coming out, I was going to a new place. I wasn't going back as such to where my troubles were. It's only recently people have made contact with me who are in care with me. And their stories are harrowing. They did go back to where they came from. And actually, and it's really hard for me to say this, and I'm quite upset even thinking about it, but one young guy, he's only a few years younger than me now, you know, he talks about his best memories today all these 3 decades on, is his time in care. And he has had a really tough life since then. He's a father, which is good, and he's got a daughter who's going on education now, and we've yet to meet, but I'm looking forward to meet him. So for me, I had a lucky break, really. When I came to Dundee, nobody knew who I was. I was going on to Kingsway Tech, which is part of Dundee College today, to train in a trade. And I didn't talk about my past at all. I rubbed it out, actually. As soon as I went into my first class, and I still wasn't even 16 yet when I went into my first class. I had the choice to go and I had to see, my birthday falls in the fall, it's in the autumn, it's in October. So ideally I was supposed to finish school between 15 and 16, but there was no point to it for me. I hated school. I left with virtually nothing. For me, the best description was it was a period of containment. Now, I don't think that was a failure of the education system, or indeed the teachers, but it was that I'd moved around 5-6 times by this point, and school wasn't a focus for me. I didn't see a positive outcomes were going to happen. So all I wanted to do was get a job. And I had delusions of grandeur, be a hotel manager. But actually, I had skills in my hands. I was far better at cooking. So I stuck in, and then I moved to a country house hotel called the Old Mansion House Hotel, which was a great place to work, really tough. And what I needed at that age, I was now 17, what I needed was structure. And I needed discipline in a way, something I could really focus on. So that really took me away from memories and thoughts about discussing my previous life. And in a way, when I think back on it now, Charlotte, I would talk about my life as if it was somebody else's life. I'd talk about, yeah, my mother's fantastic. Yeah, you know, we've come for great things, which of course didn't exist. And I maybe didn't talk about that much, but all I could focus on was I want to keep reinventing myself. And if I think about from 16 coming out of care to 24, I think I thoroughly reinvented myself. I trained as a full-time chef. I then went to work. So I trained in fully qualified in French cuisine, French Scots cuisine. I worked in this really tough hotel. But then I went to reinvent myself again. I wanted to go and study. And I thought I wanted to do psychology. So by 19, which is still young, I was already doing this career part-time as a chef and then going studying hires and A-levels. And by 21, 22, I was like, no, I'm going to go live in Europe and then I'm going to go in Asia. So by 23, I had that 100-yard stare when I come back from Asia. And I blagged St Andrews University. So St Andrews University is really tough to get in anyway in Scotland, but I was able to persuade them with this, again, talking about adaptability and resilience, to say, I'm the person you want. And actually, I want to do social anthropology. And they said, well, write me a, we've seen your grades, they're reasonable, but it's been a couple of years, it's been in education. Why don't you write us an essay on your experience in the Himalayas? So I did, and I got a position and I worked hard and I stayed on, I lived in Dundee and commuted, so I was still kind of rooted there, but.
So it's actually quite interesting then that there's evidence of the negative impact that your care experience has had, but all of that sounds like it's actually had a really, really positive influence in that you reinvented yourself and you were able to do that because of the time and care that you had. You never once mentioned that, but actually you've been able to do that because of the experience that you've got, which I think is fantastic that you've managed to do all of that. And I'm very privileged to listen to it actually just now. I think we've heard a lot about what you've done after care, so it's probably good to move on to your third and final object, which represents aftercare, where you are now, where you've been since you left. What is your last object?
Well, it's odd because it's a really odd object. I've got in my hand here something I inherited. My adult parents, so my father died when I was 23, and my mother died from advanced MS, multiple sclerosis, when I was 30, a few months after my 30th birthday. And that was a few months after I found these adoption certificates, which really made me think about who I was and where I'd come from. And although I'm adopted and I had a fairly, let's say, choppy childhood, there was only myself and my brother. So because we had our parents had no brothers or sisters, and because they were quite mature when they adopted us, I mean, I think they were in their early 40s, so we had no cousins, no uncles, no aunties. and our grandparents are dead on both sides. So anything that came down through generations ended up either in my father's hand, and when he died, I hate to say this, but it's true, when he died, neither of us wanted to go near to see if he had anything in terms of inheritance, in terms of an object, let's say. But when my mother died, she left a few things in the house that we were unaware of, myself, my brother. Now, given that she was on benefit, she was quite an astute woman. She was actually an amazing woman. She'd worked her way up through the NHS in the 50s and 60s. She was a senior nurse. She developed multiple sclerosis at a time when diagnosis wasn't very good and very misunderstood in the early 70s. And she really wanted the best for both of us. But anyway, the object to have is totally ironic because, one, it's a watch, it's about time, and it's my great-grandfather's, and I didn't know anything about it. There was two pocket watches, actually, and my brother got a pocket watch on his mother's grandfather's side, and I got the pocket watch on my father's grandparent's side, and I didn't have any close relationship until years later. So I've had this pocket watch, the gold pocket watch. It was given to my great-grandfather, whose name was John Law. My father's name was John Law, incidentally. And it has a gold chain here, and I never use it. It actually sits locked away. But the reason I love it is because when you open the back of it, it says, presented by Tullis Russell Company Limited. Now, Tullis Russell was a very large paper mill in Fife, where my mother and father worked and who met each other there. And it was presented to J.D. Law, which is my great-grandfather, who I found it subsequently, after 66 years of faithful service. So I'm like, 66 years working for the same company astonished me, first of all, because most people retire about 66. And secondly, the word faithful service really got to me, this idea of service. And the reason I say that is when I used to run these expeditions in the Himalayas on motorcycles, so 1950s Royal Enfield motorcycles, and I used to take people from all over the world, and I kind of fell into that as well, by the way. I ended up running these expeditions because I went out there, like I said, before I went to university, and I, you know, there was no money behind me. I had, you know, nothing like that. So if I want to go back to the Himalayas, how was I going to do it? I know what I'll do. I'll take people. And that's how I set up Freewheeling Travels, which was a company I set up. So you had people from all sorts of backgrounds, usually 40 plus, because they'd have a bit of disposable income. And they would do 2 weeks up to the world's highest roads in the Himalayas, which is the highest one's 18,500 feet, which is about 1,000 feet above Everest Base Camp. Were pretty dangerous expeditions looking back, and I did them over a period of on and off best part of 20 years. In fact, the last one I did was only 6-7 years ago. So why the watch? Well, apart from it has this connection to my great-grandfather, who I never knew, of course, the words faithful service came to me when I was, one expedition I ran, usually it'd be 6 to 8 motorcycles, mostly men, not always. And when I had women riding, by the way, I want to put this on record, they were the best motorcyclists of all because they listened and they would really adapt to the environment. And it's a really rough environment, particularly at high altitude. And I hate to say it, but most of the blokes I took along were pretty kind of, I know best. So, and on one particular expedition, we always had support vehicles of 4x4s. And so you'd have the mechanics and the vehicles along with all the tools and spare parts and camping equipment and whatever else I might need, emergency stuff, emergency first aid. And one of the drivers, his name was Vineet, asked me one day, literally, we're high altitude, we're sitting around a campfire, and he said, who do you serve, Chris? Now, I'm going back 15 years ago. Who do you serve? And I was really taken aback. I didn't really understand. I thought, is this a translation in his mind from Hindi to English? And this is how it comes out. I said, what do you mean? He went, who is it you serve? And I said, look, I don't serve anybody. I'm my own boss. You can just imagine the cliches as we're sitting there. I'm my own boss. I know what I'm doing. Daddy, daddy, da. I don't serve anybody. And yet here I was serving as a tour guide or an expedition leader, people around me. But I never thought of being in service. And that question is, it stuck with me. It was kind of like the question at the back of my head. And a few years ago, I came across this pocket watch as I was clearing someone out and was moving house. And I read the back and it said 66 years of faithful service. And I thought, service is underrated, actually. And I started to think about it. Service is a language of what I always imagined was the past. You'd be in servitude or you'd be a servant. But to be in service means to help others and to desire and being in helping of others. And then I thought about this man I never knew, my great-grandfather, and was he in service to Tullis Russell? Now, so he was given this in the 1950s, which means he started working there. He must have been a kid, probably a sweeper or picking up litter or whatever else, in the 1880s, 1890s. And service was something, after 66 years, he's given this gold pocket watch, which was seen for Tullis Russell. Now, a little bit about Tullis Russell's family-owned business, had a very good relationship with her staff. In fact, in the 90s, the great-grandson of the original founder gave half the company to his staff. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was amazing. And they gave it away so they would buy in to helping to develop the company. So when I think about the word service and who do I serve, it's really important to me today because I serve 67,000 constituents mm-hmm. and I serve Scotland's cause to become an independent nation again. And I'm really grateful and humbled and privileged to be in that position. So that's one of the reasons I brought the pocket watch, because of the service side, but also because it gives me a link to a family, even though they're not bloodlined, I'm part of. And the funniest story is that years, not so many years ago, I was a guest at someone's house in Fruki, whose father, I didn't know at the time when I came into the house, literally come in to drop someone off. And we were chatting, and Fruki is about 5 miles from where Tullis Russell is. And he said, I was chatting away, and he says, "Oh, hi, what's your name?" And I said, "Oh, I'm Chris, you know." And, "Oh, I believe you're involved in this campaign for independence." "Yeah, yeah, chat, mm-hmm. you know." And I said, "Are you still working?" He says, "No, I'm retired. I was at Tullis Russell's for nearly 50 years." And I went, "Were you?" And I don't remember the gentleman's name. And I said, "So when did you start there?" He said, "Oh, I was there from the late 50s onwards. But I'm retired." And I said, "My mother and father worked there. In fact, my father and his father and his father before that all worked in this mill." And he went, "Who was that?" And I said, "Well, my father was John Law." And he went, "Oh, John, he was one of my closest friends." And I went, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, we used to get drunk and drive down to Edinburgh together." Bearing in mind, this is the early 60s, clearly illegal and outrageous when I think about it today. But they used to go down to Edinburgh together in a car and get more drunk and then drive back on Saturday nights, which is appalling mm-hmm. today's terms. He said, "But that's what we did." And he says, "I know your mum." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, Jeannie, in fact, I got your mum and dad together." So, and it was a football dance on a Saturday night in Mark Inch, which is very close to the mill. And that was in the early 60s. So when that other story came together, and I said, "Hold on a minute, can I ask you a question? Did you know who my father's father was?" And he went, "Yeah, he was, your father's father was a manager." And I says, "Well, funnily enough, I've got a pocket watch and, it's to J.D. Law, which is also my father's initials, but I believe it's my great-granddad." And he went, "Oh, Old Jock Law, you mean?" And I went, "Old Jock Law? Oh, yeah, everybody knows who Old Jock Law was. He was legendary." And I went, "Really?" And it turned out that he worked his way up from whatever the job was when he was, must have left school very young. When he retired in the 50s, he was on the board of directors. But the story I want to share with you, and I'll finish this with you, and it's one that I still aspire to, it's definitely a Scottish thing about hard work gets you places. Because he said that Old Jock Law was well known, and the particularly legendary story everybody would tell about him was in the 1930s during the Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, men would turn up every day looking for work in the mill. And if there was work available, he knew how to make the choice. So three men walked down, he said, "Look," and he was a hirer and firer in the 1930s. And he said, "Chris, you need to know this about Old Jock Law. If three men walked down into the place, or four men walked down, he'd always pick the person with the holes in their trousers, who were threadbare, who were really on their hunches." And he said, "Because he needed the work most." and he chose them on that basis. So if you turned up in a good suit, which I have to say, I love a good suit these days, good tweed suit. But if you turned up in a good tweed suit, all smartly dressed, you're the least likely to get the job. So he helped build the company, but most of all, he helped people who really needed to work the most. And I really admire that. And I hope as somebody who is in service to others, that I can do that for people myself today.
It's funny that this is a family that you were adopted into, yet it's had such a massive impact now as an adult. It's life care so long ago that you've brought this, and it signifies quite a big part of your life. And it's actually led you to be in a role quite similar to what Jock was in. And you're serving people. It's symbolic, actually, I would say. Thank you for sharing that. It was a really interesting story. See, reflecting back through all these stages and objects, you talked about you love how stories are connected to objects, and that you've actually been doing that for other people. See, now doing that for yourself, reflecting back through objects, is there anything that you wish at any of these stages of your life that you had?
You mean in terms of an object?
Anything at all.
Anything. I think I wish I'd kept something from when I was in care. I think it was, which was positive to me. So obviously a record deck from the 1980s would be a bit crap today. I get that. I understand that. But I don't even have the album or albums that I had. I mean, actually, my taste in music moved very much into the late 60s, early 70s as it got later into my teens. But at the time, I felt very alone a lot of the time in care. And I'm sure other kids I was in care with felt the same. You didn't talk about these things. And the weirdest thing was when we were at school, and we got into fights, as we did. If anybody got in a fight with a kid in the home, we all stuck up for each other. Even though we fought amongst ourselves all the time. But the irony was, we were a family. And so music, and I'm actually, now that I'm talking to you about this now, I'm actually probably this weekend going to download quite a lot of music that was important to me when I was 14, 15, going on 16 at that time. So I wish I'd kept some of my 12-inch singles and tape cassettes, because there were no CDs in. In fact, tape cassettes were thoroughly avant-garde at the time. They were pretty modern. So I wish I'd kept them. I think in terms of other things is I hope that I will get to meet people who I was in care with. One of them I've already mentioned, who's had a very challenged life. And it's nice now that he gets in touch every now and again. It's literally through Facebook Messenger. I have to say, he supports Scottish Independence. He's a very sensible man. But he also gets in touch and he keeps an eye on what I'm doing in London. So if I'm inspiring him in a way, that's great. And I hope through his podcast it inspires others. And, you know, care has its own challenges. But actually growing up in a normal family circumstances that we all like to think that is the ideal actually has its own challenges too, and very often just as difficult. But I would say going forward, the things I've taken away, the things I've left behind are objects, I guess, but the things I've taken away is that I'm determined and resilient, and I want to help others as a result of the support and care and love that I actually got whilst I was through care. And it's a thing we don't talk enough about. We always read about the bad stories of people who have been in care, but actually, that's true. There's an awful experience just now down south with over 30 years of issues in one council. But, you know, there's been a lot of support and care that I've experienced. And I also hope I bump into some of those residential care workers and get a chance to tell them I'm still doing okay, thanks to them.
So you'd like to have something from that period. I think, do you know, hearing you talking about how you shut that out of your life so much, it's really nice to hear that now you're at a stage where you can go back and say, actually, I would quite like to remember that. You spent a lot of your life saying, I don't want to remember that. I don't want anything to remember that. But you're now here saying, actually, I'm ready to remember and I want to remember and I want things that will help me to remember. What a journey that has been for you. We're at the end of objects. It's been really interesting to listen. I think what I want to finish up on, and you've sort of already touched on it, but now that you've been on objects, you've been a guest and you've explored your care journey in a different way, what would you to say to other care experience people who might be interested in being a guest of Object?
Okay, that's a good question. So it's a long time since I've spoken about being in care. In fact, I didn't. So, you know, I'm in my late 40s now and here I'm doing it. I'd say, first of all, try and find out if you know other people who have been in care and get to know them, because you have a great sense of solidarity and community to share with each other. I think sharing your experience is pretty important. And it doesn't have to be of the same age group either. We have the same issues. You know, I speak to yourself, Charlotte, and I've spoken to others. In fact, when some of your colleagues in Who Cares Scotland came through to Dundee to meet with me, I was talking about the things that I was feeling now in my late 40s, and they're going, yeah, we've got them too. And so I think that's the first thing, is to reach out and to share. I think the second thing is, I would say we're fantastic people. We've got attributes that come as a result of our experience in care, and some of it can be adverse, some of it's going to be challenging, but if you can channel that constructively and positively, then we have lots to offer the world, and that's really, really valuable. And I think the third thing, which is a regret for me, is shout about it. You know, it's fantastic. It's and other people don't have that. You know, they've grown up normal, structured lives, and you say, well, hey, I've got loads I can tell you about what I've been doing and what I've experienced, and it gives you an edge actually. And often the very things that we think holds us back. And I have to say, Charlotte, up until quite recently, I used to feel, and I mean literally in the last 5 years, I've no longer felt like that. But up to about 5 years ago, I used to feel that I was 10 years behind everybody else. So, you know, I almost wish like I could turn the clock back 10 years and I'd be kind of like where everybody else is. So I did feel that my sense of shame and not being able to talk about it and not explore it held me back in developing, really. Don't let that hold you back. It is truly a gift that can be used for the benefit of yourself, first and foremost, those that you love around you, and for wider. So, yeah, I think that's the things I would say.
Thank you so much. Chris Law, MP, thank you for sharing your objects.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.